bottoms of West Oakland. This is Revolution. Today, we have a returning guest. I am very happy to say that we have professor and author and world-class debater, Rob Larson.
How you doing, man? It's good to be back.
Dude, so good to have you. So Professor Larson wrote a book that got stolen from me some months ago called Capitalism and Freedom. And I had had this whole interview planned around that book. And then he had a new book come out because he's such a prolific writer. I would not doubt if he's working on a book as we speak. And all my notes are kind of in the margins of when I read a book like that. Pretty much all the books I read, I highlight all this stuff that I want to say, ask about, read. But anyway, there's been kind of a debate here in California, especially centered around the Proposition 22 that we have that says that the ride share companies, Uber, Lyft, Instacart, Postmates, DoorDash, have to look at their drivers as employees and not as contractors. And because of the fear of what that might entail to be an employee, and they've done a great job with a fear-based campaign, the common remark I get from drivers that actually support the bill, surprisingly enough, is that they're afraid to lose their freedom. And one thing I think Professor Larson points out in his book, Capitalism versus Freedom, the toll road to serfdom, might I add, is that you don't have the freedoms that you think you have. And I getting ready for this conversation I was going to have with Professor Larson, I went to go look up some videos of his and fucking found a debate. And I don't really like watching debates too much because I watch debates almost like a sporting event. So I like yell at the TV. And David Pakman was hosting this debate. So I figured, oh, okay, I won't yell as much. It didn't matter if Pakman was hosting it. I was yelling at Pakman, who seems to be a decent individual, and I'm over here yelling at him. That's how mad I was. So first and foremost, I have to know, were you a little weirded out having to debate a man that talked exactly like Elmer Fudd?
You know, when you're talking to Ayn Rand fans, their strange way of speaking is this one of the least weird things about them. Yaron Brook is of, you know, that Ayn Rand Institute. He's not a bad guy. He just has horrible ideas about almost every subject. And Pakman runs I thought a pretty, you know, good debate. It was, we had comparable time and we didn't, he didn't let us talk over each other, which makes him better than Fox. So, it went pretty well. I feel like folks, that's on YouTube in a couple of places. Folks kind of looked it up and decide for themselves. Well, I feel like we got through, like, we at least delineated the positions on that main issue of freedom. So I feel like that debate did its job.
I mean, Pakman is extremely fair. He's extremely fair, and I can't take that away from him. You're right. He's the antithesis of a mainstream media talk show host where it becomes a firing line type thing where you guys are yelling at each other. The only thing is that guy, Yaron Brook, kind of comes from that world, in my opinion. So he had that air to him where it wasn't as much of a conversation as it was him kind of yelling bullshit. And I did have to quote one of the things he said about how capitalist the US isn't. He says, in regards to like the Gilded Age and before, which you had brought up about certain levels of inequality, which he never wanted to touch on inequality whatsoever. He says the U.S. wasn't that capitalist because it had slavery.
It's just such a fatuous remark, you know? I mean, that was one of the early capitalist industries was, well, you know, like they said on that great comedy show, Mr. Show, you know, people selling people to people. Like that's, it's one of the first industries that there is. And without all that free labor, there's no cotton boom. And people don't realize, look, like cotton, big deal. I don't wear cotton. Like cotton was the oil of that time, you know, like the whole industrialization of the northern part of the country, where we look down on the South, you know, because we have capitalism here instead of that early slave plantation economy. It was that super low cost cotton, thanks to not having to pay your workforce anything because you enslaved them and you own their children and can sell them if you want. Like, that's why that feed resource was so cheap. That's a big part of why the country is rich to this day, you know. So that's amazing to me. But also, it's kind of goofy. When I was talking to him, like, you talk to these Ayn Rand libertarians, and they say, oh, you know, the government's, you know, America's not capitalist, so we can blame our problems on the parts that aren't capitalist rather than the reality, which is that we're very capitalist here, you know. And just because these words become empty, you know, capitalism is where, you know, you get an economic system based on markets. You know, where supply and demand in markets decide how much we're going to make of different products, and where you have private property on a large scale. So not just like your personal pair of pants and your smartphone or your private property, but also like I can own all the land in a, you know, like you can be like Larry Ellison, who is a Washingtonian like me, who bought the island of Lanai, one of the Hawaiian islands. That's his island. And he bought it. This was like in 2005 or something. You know, it's a little while back there. That's interesting. You can own all the telecommunications wires in a region that bring the internet to you. You can own the oil refineries that let us have energy. Like, that's capitalism. And so the fact that we have like Social Security and Medicare so that old people can get health care even if their pension doesn't cover it. Like, that's not enough to make it socialist, Mr. Brook. I'm very sorry. So these guys have been ducking out of recognizing capitalism's problems by pegging them on the fact that government exists at all. The fact is, it's existing on top of a capitalist system, and it's kind of a cheap evasion, you know? And plus, these guys talk like Reagan never happened, you know, ever since the Reagan Revolution, you know? Since it's the neoliberal period, and we've been hacking away at the EPA, hacking away at taxes on the rich, you know, cutting labor law enforcement. The unions have been pretty crushed. Those aren't small changes, and they're all changes that move us closer to that pure capitalism of the Gilded Age, you know, the late 1800s that I was trying to get him to think about for a second. So to me, it just shows like, you know, these guys, they have a lot of intellectual pretensions and some of them have degrees and they get a lot of Koch brother, you know, dark money whose, you know, sources we can't really see. So they can be very prominent, but they're total intellectual opportunists as soon as you dig under the surface at all.
Yeah, I mean, to never really touch on inequality and to blame everything on the government. It seemed to be like anything that was wrong with the capitalism argument always came back to, well, the government is bad, ergo, capitalism is good. And I'm like, how does that even work in your mind? Like, it's just corrupt politicians and it has nothing to do with monopoly. I mean, there was a good part of the conversation that definitely went into the inherent monopolies of the capitalist system. And you brought up Microsoft and he immediately pivoted to, but it's free for the people.
Yeah. God, it's innovation. Great.
Yeah. And it always boiled down there. And there was another part where, and I'm going to shut up and let you speak because that's why I'm talking to you. There's another part where, and I think you were trying to get into it, but like we were saying earlier, there's so much to cover in the debate setting that you guys were in when it came to like the iPhone and innovation that ended up being his whole thing. Like he actually at one point said, if it wasn't for the government, we'd have flying cars by now because of all this wonderful innovation. And you were trying to you just went on the internet. You didn't even get into the whole inner workings of the iPhone like you did on the last time you were on my show. And I know you've done it before in your talks. But for him to be like, it's men like Steve Jobs and Bill Gates that have the vision They are the innovators. And I'm like, that's not necessarily how that all works, homeboy.
Yeah, you know, but it's amazing. Like what he said, like you could go on any national American media outlet and say that and everyone will just nod. Like no one will criticize it or, you know, let alone challenge it at all. Everyone was like, yeah, you know, Steve Jobs invented the iPhone alone in his bathroom. So that's impressive. You know, and Steve Jobs, you know, and Jeff Bezos is the only guy who works at Amazon. Can you believe they get us all these packages? He's the only one who works there. It's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Like what you discover is what I said to him at the time. I said, there is a record on this, you know, and it's the opposite of what you're saying. Like all these technologies, you know, not only do these guys not understand libertarianism, they also don't understand economics. They also don't understand like how technology and science work. They're incredibly expensive and they're really, really uncertain. Like you can spend a lifetime working hard as a scientist, spending real money. Science isn't cheap, you know, labs and trained people, it's costly. You can spend a lifetime doing that and be barking up the wrong tree and never discover anything important, let alone anything that's going to make you money soon. Mm-hmm. So for those reasons, like corporations and companies that are in markets, they've got profit goals to meet. They have investors who are wealthy people or big pension funds, you know, and they have like near-term quarterly profit goals that Wall Street expects them to hit. And if you're pouring big dollars into research that maybe someday will give you a new product, possibly – like you can take that large amount of money and put it into other stuff that investors like a lot more, like growing the business directly or just straight up share buybacks, which are very popular, you know, where you just put money into these stockholders' hands essentially by elevating their stock price by taking some off the market. So companies don't want to do fundamental R&D. They'll do applied research. Like once the government's, you know, like once, you know, take the internet, like once, as we talked about last time, you know, once DARPA and the Pentagon and the university system has developed the internet, oh, well, we could probably make money off this. And suddenly Bill Gates is very interested after he laughed off the internet all through the early 90s. Once it became a product and Netscape Navigator was letting people go to all these fun different websites, suddenly they give a shit and they work very hard to crush Netscape and make everyone use Internet Explorer because they bundled it into the Microsoft Windows platform, which of course was the way you use computers at that time. Just using their market power to crush a rival after it pioneered technology that the government had developed originally. So it's just like the opposite of the tale that these idiots peddle, you know? And like you were saying, yeah, like even the guts of most of today's smartphones, that fundamental tech comes from various government sectors where you can do research and lose money on it for years and no one cares because you're the military and you're allowed to burn through money, you know. Mm-hmm. So our modern antennas come from Army signal, you know, intelligence research, you know, the multi-touch interface, which defines how smartphones work. Like that's mostly public sector research and a small firm or two that Apple bought up that was funded through National Science Foundation money. Like it's all on the record. Like no one disputes any of these bits in the story. But when they then say, well, Steve Jobs created the iPhone, they just fucking ignore it completely. Like it's pretty ugly that these people are considered big intellectuals or like the savvy people who understand business. Like you need to learn economics, which is that Jeff Bezos created DNA. Like they don't know anything about any of these stories of these firms or these technologies. And so I tried to get, you know, a few bits of that into a debate. That's the thing about debates, like we were saying before we got on the air here. It's, you know, I believe in debates. I'm all for them. You know, some libertarian, you know, with a following who wants to debate me, you know, bring it on. You dummies aren't very scary. But the reality is you're in a rush. It is a goofy format and I'm pro debate. It's better in print because there you can add a paragraph to like clarify or add something important that helps people understand. Debates, you're in a hustle and you've got 90 seconds or less to make some rebuttal and you need to address the new question you were asked. And it's a lot more about, I mean, I'm pro debate, but in the moment, it's a lot more about like performance than it is about being objectively the most correct person a lot of the time.
And that's, and I'm not going to lie, man. It's just not for me. I'm a little too... Like you can take the kid out the hood, but like there's a few moments where I'm like, look, man, you tell another lie, double dog dare you.
You got to let go of that instinct if you want to do a debate. Yeah, you've got to be willing to emotionally just put to the side the fact that someone's just nakedly lying to thousands of people right in front of you, you have to like be willing, you know, to like take that breath and go, all right, here is a list of reasons why you're wrong in alphabetical order, rather than saying, look, shit for brains, you make up one more damn thing and I'm going to pull the plug on it. You know, you really can't. And look, it's I'm not saying I'm great at it myself. I do my best. Some people have done a lot more of this than I have, but it's a difficult art, you know, it's its own weird skill.
It is. And it's very performative. And what's interesting is that cats like that, and this is why I really don't like cats like that, and why I'm yelling at the computer screen watching this thing earlier this morning. And my girlfriend works from home and she's having all these Zoom meetings as I'm yelling at the screen, and she goes, this is making you very angry, isn't it? And so I'm interjecting why I'm angry. And what pisses me off about that kind of stuff, and why I don't do it today, why I don't do it, you know, I can't say where I'll be tomorrow and how I feel about this, is I know people that all they need to hear is a little bit of what those people say, and they go and run with it because those people aren't talking factual. They're talking usually ahistorically, and it's a lot of emotion. So when they feed off emotion, and watch a PragerU video, anyone listening right now, watch a PragerU video if you think I'm lying. It's emotion. It's not based in a lot of fact. It's based off how you feel about something.
It's true, but you got to realize too, like that they've spent a lot of years working at hiding that. Like again, if you do watch a PragerU video, and you know, brace yourselves, listeners, if you do that, like they're stupid. So we should mention that. But it's all like calm, and it appears to be fact based because they use the three facts that help their side and ignore all the others, and mention a third of something to make it misleading. Like they're all about on the right these days, like we're the ones who want debate. The left is emotional and is scared of debate, which, you know, and then their proof is here's Ben Shapiro arguing with a 17-year-old college freshman.
Exactly.
And he has the microphone and talks over her. And so, wow, the left can't handle the debate. It's pretty weak sauce. But the fact is, like, they're into the affectation of being calm and smarter and, you know, more detached and intellectual than thou and all that shit. So it's just like what you were saying was completely correct. People watch a little of this. They're kind of paying attention. To me, it's a little bit less that they're getting like an emotional affirmation. To me, it's more like a, you know, like what they call a catechism, like in religious studies, like the simple, like a couple sentence version of a religion. They call that the catechism, like John 3:16. Mm-hmm. You know, like that's what it is. People are like, yeah, markets are good. Entrepreneurs create jobs. Markets are innovative and they created products. Government's bad and it caused all of our problems. Even the ones I can see capitalists doing, they caused that. Like people, like that's what people like, is a couple sentences that affirms all the dumb crap they already believe. Like that's how Fox works. That's how PragerU works. Yes. And there's plenty of emotion in there, mainly emotion about how horrible leftists and liberals are. Mm-hmm. I think most of the emotion is, but liberals are communists and they're fascists and they're Antifa. Like it doesn't make much sense, but it's just like towering white boomer denunciations of young people and anyone who's to the left of Ronald Reagan. Like that's where the emotion is, but they're happy to give you super calm six sentence summaries of capitalism about how it's innovative and how inequality is okay because we all have different skills. So we should be unequal. And if you're having to do a GoFundMe for your kid's insulin while Mike Bloomberg has, you know, made $1 billion just last year, that's just because of how harder he works than you. It's really stupid, but just in a few sentence form, you can get people to believe that. So that's kind of the weird contours of today's propaganda.
And it becomes a narrative that in my opinion is like very strong, because again, as we have this proposition in California 22, where, and I don't know that by the time this airs, the voting probably will be done. $180 million these rideshare companies have dumped into the propaganda, and it all stems from saying being an employee is bad. like you're going to have all this freedom as a contractor. And so when I ask people, have you read the law? They all say yes, and they haven't. Because the law is just basically says, look, if this proposition passes, then the minimum wage that these rideshare companies are guaranteeing is $5.64 an hour, which is lower than the federal minimum wage. And it's much lower than what minimum wage is in San Francisco and Oakland and Los Angeles. And that's not a benefit. And they were going to give some sort of like low tier or access to some sort of low tier benefits, healthcare benefits. The law says you get paid sick days. And for your idle time, you are going to get a minimum wage based on people that work so many hours. And there was a few other things that the law had of worker protections. Like you can get worker compensation now. You can get unemployment. These are all things you couldn't get before. And when you say that, and these are people that call themselves leftists that are upset about this. They're like, well, look, man, you're going to take away my ability to make money. And I'm like, well, I don't think a law that really comes from the organization efforts of literally millions of drivers throughout the entire state of California is going to be to go against your best interests. And because it's so interesting when you say employee, and to me, this says a lot about the authoritarian structure of just business in the system that we're in. People revert automatically to the worst job they ever had. And they don't look at it like, for example, I asked, you know, the woman I live with and date who makes a pretty good living in medical research. She's an employee. I said, so contractor and employee, like what's your definition of a contractor and employee? And even when I said employee, she didn't revert to where she is as an employee, where she has a lot of freedom, she makes a lot of money, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
she reverted back to being an employee when she was a kid and working a retail job. And there's something to be said about that word almost being a bad word. And it's being used as a scare tactic. And I just want to ask you, because I can hear you want to jump in. You have a great definition of freedoms in the system that we live in right now.
Yeah,
can you expand on that?
Yeah,
can you expand
for sure,
on
yeah.
that?
Yeah, you know, so, yeah, well, it is it's like you said a second ago, like it's just incredibly authoritarian system that we're in now, you know, authoritarian meaning like the opposite of libertarian, like filled with authority and big power centers, you know, and that's Proposition 22, I guess. Yeah. In California is kind of an interesting example of that. You know, I live in Washington. I'm no big expert on this, but, you know, up here in the Northwest, we're kind of economic satellites of California up to a point. So we kind of have to pay some attention there. And, you know, it's by far the biggest economy in the country, of course, California. There's a reason why people pay so much attention to it. It's incredible. Like that bill is essentially mandates, you know, all Uber and Lyft and all these other online platform startups. You can't treat all your value creating participants in your platform. You can't treat them as contractors anymore. Because these people, you know, are putting in huge amounts of time for your platform between rides or meeting other requirements of yours for their car maintenance and stuff that you don't cover at all. You have to treat them as employees, especially with the growth of the platforms. But Uber and Lyft immediately say, and I assume that they're basically telling the truth about this. I mean, what we know about the companies jives with this claim. They said, if we have to pay these people like a minimum wage, just a minimum wage, we'll go out of business. We can't afford that. We don't make nearly enough money to pay ourselves big CEO money and pay them a minimum wage, let alone a living wage, you know. Yeah. But that's amazing because all this is, like all through this period, it's, well, you know, we're an innovative platform, we're Uber, we're super flexible, people can work whenever they want. We've created this whole new kind of work that people can do. We're amazing job creators. But then as soon as it turns out that if they have to pay their employees, they're not viable. So it's not really a business model.
Thank you.
Well, if we have to pay our workers, of course we can't operate. Okay, so you don't really have a business model then. is what that should be saying to people who are supposed to be savvy conservatives who believe they understand how markets work. Like, this isn't a business model if paying your workers is beyond what the model can afford. And you can't say you're a job creator, because as soon as someone says, okay, well, you have to treat these people like they're actual job holders, and we go, well, we can't afford for it to be real jobs. It's a job where you get a dollar a ride sometimes. Like, that's not a job. So as soon as the government says, all right, you have to treat these people like they're actual jobs, they go, oh, well, we can't treat them as actual jobs. We're job creators on paper, not in reality. And so that's why, like we were saying before we went on the air, yeah, if you look at those nice, you know, infographics that great progressive champions have made, like, no one likes to look at numbers, but anyone likes to look at a table with different size things based on how much money is involved. Anyone can understand that. It's great for democracy when people do that. And you look at these, you know, you have nice visualizations of the different referenda, you know, the propositions that are on the ballot in California for this election cycle. And it shows you how much money and from whom is going for and against each one. And for 22, it's this giant block from Uber and giant block of ad spending supporting it from Lyft and a bunch of other huge corporate platforms. And then way on the right, you can barely make out the opposing spending, you know, support, you know, in opposition to 22, trying to make these people employees. And it's a tiny square that says SEIU and another tiny square with another little union on it with its tiny level of spending. And to these platforms, this is an existential fight. You know, like, they could end up not functioning in the same way or at all as a result of this. So they're willing to throw everything they got at defeating this, you know, California bill that 22 is supposed to supersede. So we'll see how it goes. You know, it's amazing, though, like, how hard these companies are so eager. And again, they spend money every year, you know, on ads for themselves and funding think tanks that will defend them. They spend so much money saying, well, we're job creators. We shouldn't be taxed or insulted. We create jobs. We're good. As soon as someone says, OK, well, then pay them health insurance, they throw every penny they've got at fighting that. It goes to show what a phony, sham capitalist job creation is. You know, it's. No benefits, no security, tiny amounts of money. You're a contractor. You take on all the risks and the liability of running your car and keeping it nice, you know. But as soon as the state forces us to pay into health insurance, it's all a house of cards. It's going to fall down. Like, it shows what a kind of total fraud this is. So to get back to what you said, though, about freedom. You know, traditionally, the way liberals and conservatives talk about capitalism is they say it's a free system, you know, free markets, free enterprise. And they do that based on one of the classic philosophical definitions of freedom, which is negative freedom. Negative freedom is about what you're being free from other people telling you what to do. And we sometimes call it freedom from, like, from outside interference. So if the government, you know, drafts you and makes you fight in Vietnam, that's violating your negative freedom, because it's forcing you, you know, forcing you to do something from an outside power center acting on you and coercing you into doing something. And so we say, well, markets don't do that. You can choose what kind of smartphone you want to buy. You can choose what kind of sneakers you want to wear. So you have market choice, so you have negative freedom. Now, there's also positive freedom, or what people sometimes call positive liberty or positive rights, where it's about what you're free to do. So if our society is able to produce enough healthcare for everyone, where we can more or less meet everyone's healthcare needs with our existing amount of hospital beds and hospital clinic staff hours and so on. Do people have the freedom to go and have their diabetes looked at, or their car crash whiplash examined, or go when they think they have COVID-19? Or if a lot of people can't afford it, do they not have the right to go into the hospital and have their disease treated, even though we could, but you can't afford it, or you're outside of your insurance network or whatever? Well, liberals and conservatives agree that capitalism does not provide positive freedom. In capitalism, you know, in the marketplace, you don't have a right to healthcare. You don't have an entitlement to, you know, a meal. Okay, you have to work for them, and that's supposed to be a strength of the system. Okay, what I argue in that last book, Capitalism Versus Freedom, which folks can take a look at, is really capitalism doesn't provide either of these freedoms. We all agree it doesn't provide positive freedom. That's in the bank. We can all agree to that. But I would argue that if GM has the ability to destroy Michigan's economy by moving all of its factories to Mexico, because of an unilateral investment series of decisions they made in the 80s and 90s, or if Jeff Bezos can decide whether or not an American city gets to have a future by his decision on where he's going to put his second headquarters, which captivated this country a couple of years ago. Yeah. Like, those are powerful plays. These companies have power, and Apple has the ability to decide what apps appear on your smartphone store. You know, Google can decide what search results it wants to surface and which ones it wants to suppress. It claims it doesn't, but we have a long record of it doing it. Even the Wall Street Journal, which is very conservative, has proof of that, you know. What all these things go to show is that these firms have real power, and when they decide to act on us, it violates our positive liberty. So I think this is a good way of seeing that, you know, like we try to pass some referendum through democracy, and these companies can pour cash into shaping the outcomes. Mm-hmm. It shows they've got real power, and that has real ramifications for infringing on our positive liberty, on our negative liberty, as well as the positive one, which we agree we don't have.
And it's so funny you bring up the Google search thing. Someone on Twitter just recently, and I can't remember the person's name, had said they did a Google search, and the Google search was capitalism's failures.
Yes.
You saw that?
I did see that, yes.
And the only thing that came up was socialism's failures and people killed under socialism. You couldn't find any failures under capitalism. And then all these people saw the tweet and the picture, and they started to do it themselves because they were kind of in disbelief. And when you have that level of control where you can literally show people, like this is what you're going to see.
For sure. What is more powerful than that? Absolutely. And especially just considering how widely used Google is, and, you know, Bing and Yahoo search are going to give you similar things, that suggested search, as Google puts that. It's very popular. And again, for non-political stuff, it's handy. You know, like if you put in, weather today, it'll fill in your town based on where it knows you are, yeah, from 30 indicators of where you are, from your ISP to your GPS chip on your phone to whatever else. Like, it can be handy. Like, it's not inconvenient. But then, of course, because we rely on Google so much, like, it gives the ability to just filter ideas to people before they even think about, like, what the question is, you know. And it's incredible. To behold that stuff, it's amazing. I mean, Google users, people use Google and the other tech platforms too, in the most naive way you can imagine. You know, people treat these things like they're little mechanical devices that just live on their phone, and they're just little impartial oracles that answer your questions and point you to resources. People don't realize this. I say this in every interview I'm in, so I'm sure I've said this to your listeners already. Any search you ever into any tech platform search field, they keep. They keep a record of it. They keep a record of who you are and what you searched for based on whatever identifiers they can pin on you individually. And they're going to look at which results you clicked on, which ones you clicked on and then came back because they weren't good enough. And they use that to refine the search and get more detail about you. Whatever embarrassing things your listeners have searched for, I don't know what it is. I don't know what weird shit. I don't know what weird shit your audience is into, but they know, and Google knows. That's who knows. Not me, but the Google Corporation of Menlo Park, California, they're aware. And that's relevant. You know, it means these firms by now have racked up so much information about us, Facebook, Amazon, and Google being the big ones, that it's kind of messed up. You know, I include myself in this. For years, I was kind of a naive user of search engines like anyone else, you know, so I shudder to think of what they know about my weird personal quirks, you know. But that's the thing about this just speaks to the power that these firms have. That's all. And that's what I've been trying to draw people's attention to. It's not just the state that has power. I mean, everyone agrees governments have power. They can tax you. They can tell you when you can, you know, when it's your turn to go through the intersection and when it isn't. Mm-hmm. And if you don't pay your taxes, you go to jail. I mean, that's the state has power. Everyone can see that. But if I own media and I can shape what ideas people hear because I own Fox News, or if I own Alphabet Corp and so I decide what Google will suggest for search terms that include the word capitalism, mm-hmm, and make sure it smears socialism before people even type in a second word, like, if you're going to tell me that's not power, I'll eat my hat. Like, it's just not.
I think in your debate, back to, I have to reference this debate, man, because I didn't sit there for a fucking hour yelling at the screen, and I can't give you shit about this debate.
I understand.
You kind of referenced that, and the dude came back to, hey, you can go to Bing if you want to go to Bing. You can use, there's search engines you can use that don't even collect your data. I was like, man, if you don't shut the fuck up, who the hell is on Bing?
Yeah, who is on Bing is people who are using their PCs at work which run on Windows. And so when you click on any kind of search thing, it defaults to Bing. So that's what I said in reply to that. Like, yeah, but no one uses search engines like DuckDuckGo. You know, Bing is owned by Microsoft, and it's just a Google that vacuums up data, but no one uses it nearly as much as Google. So it has shittier results because its algorithm isn't as trained, you know, as Google's is. Like, Bing is no better. It's just a two-firm oligopoly, you know, a small number of giant firms, which is not much better than a monopoly if you look at how the market outcomes go. But there are search engine alternatives. Like, yeah, DuckDuckGo is popular. I know a lot of like leftist sites that are using that now. And their whole thing is, we don't collect your personal data and track your ass and have cookies on every other site like Google does to keep track of you, even when you're not using Google search or YouTube, you know, which is nice. But it means the search results are clunkier because it's nowhere near as trained as even Bing, let alone Google in its search algorithm. But more to the point, no one uses it because it's not the default. Like Google itself, I talk about this in BitTyrants, like they know that the defaults, the things that like the, you know, the settings that your phone or your phone software comes with is the most important thing shaping what people do, you know, with their phones and their software. And so Google's, and you know, most phones run on Android operating system. That's, you know, Google's operating system for mobile that it maintains, right? And so it defaults to the Chrome browser, which is Google's browser, which feeds data back to Google. And of course, its search, you know, defaults to Google search. You can change the defaults if you want to take some time, go into the preferences, dig around, find them. You probably want to do some research first on what you want to change it to. What a pain in the ass. Do you realize how few kids with smartphones are like, how do I really feel comfortable about Google's data collection preferences? I'm not sure if I feel good about that. People do, but it's savvy people who are already kind of suspicious about tech and use it in different ways, you know, that let them be a little less tracked or whatever, you know, they want to do with it. Like, that's not typical. So he could say, well, alternatives do exist. And I can say, yeah, and no one uses them because the super powerful platform gatekeepers that became monopolists or two companies, company oligopolists through the straight up capitalist economics of these markets, they're the gatekeepers who decide what the defaults are and decide what you're going to start with. And so, big surprise, those are the outcomes that most people use. Like, those are the browsers and, you know, search options that most people use because they're the ones presented to them by the platform. And what a coincidence, the ones that they present are the ones that, you know, are good for their firm and its data collection and its advertising revenue and so on like that. So, like, his examples all actually show how wrong he is if you look at the reality of them, which, of course, is, you know, it's hard to fit it in into a 90-second.
Oh, no. I was watching your face, and there was moments I was like, he's hella trying to keep it cool right now.
No, I wasn't. I have perfect poker face. You can never tell I'm
angry. No, that was
impossible.
I'll put the timestamps. I'll send you an email with the timestamps of where you were like, there's a couple times, and you try to like smile it off like, hold this motherfucker right here.
Yeah, you know, you are on stage. You are, you know, you are being looked at. You have to, you know, you have to appear to be having fun. That is a part of the performance of it, for better or worse.
And you know, and he was doing it too. He wasn't sitting there, you know, stone face. He definitely, you know, did his same thing. Oh, this motherfucker right here, back at you. It's what's interesting to me when you talk about the data collection. And a lot of people, and I think it does, to your point, it doesn't really matter the age either, don't understand the importance of data collection. And I think they think it's just advertising. Like, oh, you mean those ads I get for things that I like? Like, I just ignore them, or I don't mind the ads. It's like, it's bigger than just the ads you get. This is like predicting your behavior.
And shaping it, you know.
It's
true. Like in online retail, like e-retail, for example, and not just there, like, you know, a lot of online presences, you have, you know, what they call dark patterns. Like, that's the phrase that's used in the industry. And I know it from the Wall Street Journal reporting on it, you know. It's dark. Good girl. my buddy's here. you know, that's where you do little tricks on screen to manipulate people's behavior. Like, you put, when people go to a shopping site, it says this item's on sale and this sale's going to end, and they put a little clock up on screen counting down, and there's no sale, it's not ending, that's the normal price for that item. But doing that, they make some consumers will feel like it's more urgent and they'll maybe make a purchase that they wouldn't have otherwise. And you tell them it's on sale when that's actually the standard price point. And people do have done this stuff all the time, you know, like phony markdowns is a tradition as old as retail. But there's a lot of this you can use to manipulate people's behavior. And you know, the firms are not above doing this. You know, they're capitalist entities. They've got Wall Street profit targets to meet, and you don't meet them by leaving money on the table by knowing you could manipulate consumers through online platforms and just not doing it. Like, that's not a thing that happens usually. So it's true. It's more than just, yeah, it's more than just that weird item from Amazon you looked at that follows you around the web, as creepy as that is itself. Like mm-hmm. the amount of data collection is far deeper than this. I mean, that was the whole Cambridge Analytica thing, was Facebook having all that data that people put into Facebook 10 years ago when it was just a fun diversion everyone liked to keep in touch with their friends who live in other states. And it turns out all that data was getting exfiltrated by a bunch of apps that were saying, this is a psychology, what personality do you have? Mm-hmm. And then they were able, once as soon as you interface with that app, they were able to pull all your data and the data of everyone in your friend network, you know. Like, it's more than just profiling your deferred consumer purchases. It's trying to make the fullest profile that they can. Like, Google refers to them as super profiles, and they play down how much they know about you from that. But between what they know about you from your search history and your YouTube viewing habits and tracking you around the entire web with double-click super invasive cookies, you know, they have a pretty comprehensive picture of people. My favorite thing is Facebook refuses to say, they refuse to say whether they maintain like shadow profiles of people they know exist but don't have Facebook accounts.
Oh,
it's
wow.
more than just some ad tracking you. Like, it's like shady, comprehensive, global data profiling of anyone that they can learn to exist.
And then they can sell all this to marketers.
Oh, yeah.
Politicians, as we found out.
The whole point of this, in terms of the business model, yeah, is to have more targeted ads. Like, the whole point of this is to have more ads that you see, which is great. You know, I remember years ago, like in the late 90s, somewhere back there, it's in the book, I forget exactly. The Wall Street Journal referred to the once eclectic web, you know, back in the 90s when it was, you know, kind of clunky and a smaller number of websites, you know, but it's very free spirited then. Now they said it's the 24-hour marketing machine. Everything has big, ugly, eyesore commercials on it. Google's one of the biggest reasons that that happened, because that's a big tracking tool for them, you know, using the cookies that go onto your phone or PC browser every time you go to a website. Like, when you open dictionary.com, it puts dozens of cookies on your phone or computer. Like, it's far more than people even realize. And I, you know, wrote a lot about it, and I feel like I only see part of the picture, frankly.
And that's scary. And that's the thing. People are just, I don't want to say naive, but there's just a level of kind of like arrogance towards the fact that they are in control. And I think that goes back to your freedom discussion. Like, I think people look at these, it's my phone. I control my phone. I know what I look at. I just say no to the ad, not realizing that how long you look at shit, what you look at when you think you're scrolling through. The fact that all of our time is on these devices now.
Yeah, especially in these times of calamity, you know, these firms' stocks have like powered the entire NASDAQ up dramatically. Like, the big tech tech platform stocks have like just driven this ridiculous market rally all through this year of fairly major recession, which we've experienced and will probably continue. It's kind of up in the air. If we get a new administration, we'll probably get a new stimulus bill, which makes significant difference fiscal policy. Right now, we're getting nothing because Mitch McConnell doesn't care for it. It is tremendous. Like, of course, the reason why that stock has shot up so much is because people are spending more time online, more time on their phones. You're stuck at home or not working anyway. So for a large part of us who aren't essential workers, you know, we're spending more time online, more time streaming, more time looking at social media. Every one of these things, you know, is good for the top and bottom lines of these companies. And so their stock has shot up and driven up the whole stock index with it in a major recession year. It's incredible to see. You know, these are the goofy times we live in. If people are so confident that none of their data is getting pulled out, I need you to explain to me why Wall Street and investors are so eager to buy these stocks and push up their prices, you know, as a result of that. Because Wall Street sure thinks that these companies are hoovering up our data and getting more dominant than ever. So if you've got another explanation, I'm all ears.
Okay. So I don't want to take too much of your time. I know you're busy today. So I do have to, I'm going to ask you this last very long question. Yeah, man. Socialism and freedom. The capitalist / libertarian response to that, which was Dude's response to that, which I thought was really interesting that he grew up in this, the socialist non-paradise of Israel.
Yeah.
When I think of Israel, I don't really think of socialism, but that's just me and my wacky takes. And I did have to do a little lookup on that. I was like, really? Did that kind of hit you by surprise too when he says that Israel was socialist, or did you know a little bit about that?
No, because Israel, you know, he's referring to back in the social democratic period of the New Deal, you know, when he would have been a kid, you know, he's like a boomer, I guess, you know, however old he is. Like Israel, you know, had a long history under its labor government, you know, which was what labor governments used to be before they became the other corporate party to go with whatever conservative party they have. In Israel, that's Likud. In the UK, it's the Tories, whatever. Mm-hmm. Those parties used to be in favor of things like the social safety net and the National Health Service and very things that are extremely popular with Americans, Israelis, and Brits to this day, but that we trash constantly now because that's big government and you don't want that, you know. So for sure, like back when he was a kid, you know, Israel, and you know, to this day, you know, Israel, like most developed countries, has at least public health care. You know, public health insurance anyway, like some countries like Britain have full-on public health care, like the hospitals, clinics are publicly owned. Others like Canada, you know, have public insurance, which, you know, works very well too. Anything but what we have with private care and insurance, which is just a nightmare. But he can refer to like the problems of that era and say, see, that's caused by the government being socialist. What happens with these guys is as soon as there's any government policy doing anything for anybody that they're not getting from markets, they can say, see, now it's socialism. Everything that's bad is happening because of socialism. Yaron Brook in that debate claimed we have a socialist healthcare system because Medicare makes up a large part of the buying. Because you know, once you're over, what is it, 65, I guess, once you're old enough, you can get on American Medicare where you get public health insurance. That's why we push for Medicare for All, because that program is very popular. It has very low administrative costs, much lower than the insurance corporations that the rest of us are stuck with, you know. And so that program is very positive. It's the thing we should most be twisting Biden's arm for when he comes in, along with a new Voting Rights Act, which we desperately need, or we're not going to get any of this shit. But so, yeah, Yaron Brook can say that stuff because these guys are so dishonest. As soon as there's any significant part of the economy that's run publicly, they can say, oh, it's all socialist now. None of our problems could possibly be because of capitalism. Even though in Israel, just like America, most of the land's privately owned, the industry's privately owned, the telecom industry is private. You know, it's mostly private property. But hiding behind governments and claiming that socialism is a great dodge for these guys and their phony intellectual enterprise. So I wasn't too surprised by that. That said, though, Israel has its weird, unique history. You know, like it's an especially militarized society. If he wanted to say it was government dominated, he should have referred to the military. Like Israel has compulsive military service. If you're a male born into Israel and you're not that super arch conservative branch of Israeli Judaism, I forget the name of it right now. I'm not an Israel expert, but for the huge majority of the population. For the huge majority, you're serving in the military. Like, that's not what he complained about, which is real government authoritarian overreach. He should have complained about that. Instead, it's, oh, labor, and it made it hard for me to start a business. That's why America has the software giants and not Europe or Israel, because here we're more capitalist. But, of course, as we discussed last time, it's actually because we had the leading tech edge in Cold War-based public research funding is why we have all this technology. So these are the kind of, like, you know, that might sound ridiculous to you, like Israel is socialist. I don't think that's true. If you mainly watch Fox and read Breitbart and are into libertarianism, you'll never get outside of that ludicrous type of thinking. Like, oh, there's a government arm in the economy, so now it's all socialism. Like, this is, I mean, that might sound ridiculous, but I got to tell you, this is the level of public discourse in the social sciences. It's pretty embarrassing.
And there's this thing where they immediately go socialism you know, and you were kind of just touching on it, is going to infringe on any freedoms you have. Just recently, I spoke with a gentleman named Gregory Wilpert, who wrote a really good book about Chavez's Venezuela when he was first rolling out the Bolivarian Project and that constitution and all the things that it entailed. And one of the really great things, in my opinion, that it entailed was like all these ways for the poorest people in the country to be able to form like worker cooperatives. And he was setting aside money so they could start their own businesses.
Yeah, that's kind of incredible too, because I forgot the main part of your question there. Like, none of this is anywhere near like socialism, you know. Mm-hmm. This is what they call social democracy, you know, where you have like the National Health Service, or if we had Medicare for all, you know. That's like a government stepping in and managing some subsector of the economy that we're deciding runs better as a public service than as a market commodity. Like, we have, you know, public firefighters in America. Okay, that used to be private. Until the 1910s and 20s, it was mostly fire brigades where you had to pay a local firefighting brigade to put out fires. It was basically like insurance. You know, you pay them money, and if you have a fire, they come and put it out. But if you were poor or didn't pay for insurance and you had a fire, they'd let your house burn down and your kids all die from smoke inhalation, you know? And people realize, like, this is pretty inhumane, and we can afford to maintain people on the clock as public employees. Let's make this a public service. And so we see things like firefighting and, you know, law enforcement, for better or worse, and education as being public goods, you know, like the national defense. It's something that you can't really expect markets to do this for people. It's not fair, and they tend to not provide enough of it. And with things like health and fires, if you don't go after them aggressively, even if it's happening to a poor person, they can cough on someone and make them sick, or the fire can spread to a nicer neighborhood, you know, so we might as well make this a public good. Because its tendency, you know, has a way of spreading, and it works better this way than in the marketplace. And this is good. And this is what everyone holds up as socialism. Socialism refers to worker control of that means of production, you know, that big productive private property we talked about, you know, like oil refineries, agricultural land, the telecom wires that bring the internet to us, the big private property, not your personal house or clothes or car, but the big shit that produces the goods and services we all rely on. Socialism said that shit should be publicly owned and run by the workers. That's the main thing. It's some form of worker-based democratic decision-making about the big investments that are going to happen. So that rather than Jeff Bezos or General Motors board deciding who gets to have an economy, and maybe everyone wants us to keep the production in this country, but we'll make somewhat more money if we move it to El Salvador. You know, we should do that. With socialism, it would be up to, you know, there would be a public veto over that sort of stuff, and workers would be unlikely to propose that they, you know, that everyone lose their job anyway. Like, that would be socialism. So it's interesting, like with Chavez and with most governments that people call socialist, it's mostly governments trying to do social democracy, like provide healthcare or education to people, and most property is still private. So I would say Chavez, Venezuela was mostly a capitalist economy even then. The big exception was its oil sector, which got nationalized some time before Chavez, as is common, like in Saudi Arabia. You know, right-wing governments do that too, like the Saudi royal family does, you know. But when you have things like, Chavez creating this grant program where you give workers, you know, pretty modest amounts of money, but let them run the business themselves or make it, you know, a cooperative or nonprofit so it doesn't have to follow market rules and make money constantly. Like, those are steps toward real socialism. And they all got completely destroyed with the collapse of the price of oil, which was actually the main thing that's kind of destroyed Venezuela. Then came the U.S. sanctions, which are, you know, U.S. can lock a country out of the financial system because the U.S. dollar is the main currency for global transactions. So if the U.S. government sanctions you, it's not like being sanctioned by France. Like, U.S. can crush your economy alone by sanctioning you. It's doing it to Syria, for God's sake, right now, to crush those poor people even more.
Exactly.
So Venezuela is completely smashed. People say it's because of socialism. The crash of the price of oil and U.S. sanctions are kind of more plausible. But you do have gestures from Chavez towards socialism, you know. And I would say, you know, I visited Venezuela during that time. It was a republic. Chavez lost that big referendum in 2004 or whichever year that was, that was going to give him an extra term. He lost and said, well, I think you guys are making a mistake, but then he accepted the referendum. Like, that's a republic. Like, that's elections being decided, you know, democratically. So socialism and freedom to me is if people want to get some positive freedom where you have a right to health care, you have a right to food if you're starving, you have a right to insulin if your society can produce it. And also you can get more negative freedom because now we don't have Jeff Bezos and Mike Bloomberg deciding who gets to have an economic future. This is how you get freedom. And to me, this all comes from having some kind of real socialization of the economy, not meaning the government takes over everything and we have a government bureaucracy deciding what we get instead of a corporate bureaucracy. We want a system where when you go to work, you and your coworkers decide what you're going to do rather than management telling you. And you have access to the information that management usually hoards to itself about how the business is doing and what you need from other companies and so on. And you make those decisions on a basis of free association and where you're, where representatives that work with your suppliers and distributors, where you have, you can recall people if they stop representing what the workers want. Like, that's socialism. That to me represents like real potential for human liberation and freedom rather than having, you know, billionaires who are now so rich that people like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, and Richard Branson have their own private space programs now. That's how rich the billionaire class has become. This is freedom. Poor kids. Like, I personally know people who are, you know, like, are doing GoFundMes for their kids' insulin. We can easily produce all the insulin we want, but drug companies are able to buy up the production and then quintuple the price overnight because they're satanically evil and have no mercy because they're market entities. They're trying to make money today, not in the long run, but right now. Like, that's, you're going to tell me that's the best we can do for human freedom? I think there's a reason why young people are increasingly pro-socialism, even though there is zero pro-socialist media in America in terms of TV news and the big, you know, news outlets that people know. Your brand name news would never support socialism. They took the opportunity to piss on Bernie Sanders' campaign from a great height. He's just a social Democrat. You know? So there's a reason why young kids, I think, are more and more favoring this and why even older people are giving ideas around socialism or at least social democracy like Medicare for All. People are giving it a second look. I think they should. People want freedom. They want a way to survive. They'd like to see the environment not be destroyed. I'm in Washington. You're in California. Climate change is here. It's destroying our big economic states. And, you know, that smoke goes across America, people. We got to fight climate change right now. And Joe Biden's not going to want to do it. We're going to have to put our foot up his ass to make it happen. But we could succeed if we, like, worked on it. So, like, this is what we should be doing in this fucked up, despairing era that we are in. It's not just get rid of Trump. Like, we need to actually work together, go to DSA or form your own group, form a union. When you are doing even a small thing to move the world in a direction of freedom and equality and a stable environment, it will make you feel better, I promise. It really has that effect. So that's what I would say to your listeners. You know, want to feel better? Need some, you know, got to do some self-care? Do a little organizing work in some modest way that's not a pain in the ass. You will feel better. That's my prescription.
Well, he is Rob Larson, author of Bit Tyrants, out right now on Haymarket Books, and Capitalism vs. Freedom on Zero Books. I will put links up, buy links up for both of those books. Professor Larson, is there anything else that you're doing other than professing on those children up north?
Children and adults. It's a community college. You know, we get lifelong learners. So it's all over the board. One thing I'd say is, you know, I got a lot coming out with Current Affairs these days. I'm kind of working with them a lot. You know, one of the big socialist magazines along with Jacobin. I had a review come out that I wrote of some libertarian children's books, which are it's exactly as bad as you're imagining. It's the Tuttle Twins series, which is put out by another Ayn Rand fan based in Utah. And this stuff's in schools. Like, it's in schools. And it's abominable libertarian propaganda for little kids, kids who are too young to have, like, critical thinking skills, like kids that believe in Santa still and shit like that. But these guys have no integrity or intellectual standards at all, as we've said. So if you look at this, it's all about getting kids to believe in, you know, the Koch brothers and Ayn Rand. It's fucking disgusting. And I wrote a review. If you go to Current Affairs, it's toward the top of the page. The Tuttle Twins, the article I wrote, you know, it's all about like mysteries and fun kid stuff is how it's packaged. So I wrote The Tuttle Twins and the Case of the Really Bad Libertarian Propaganda.
Oh my God.
The authors of those books aren't very happy with me. And we've been having some fairly acidic Twitter exchanges. So take a look at that Current Affairs article. And some other, you know, I've done a lot of writing for them. You can check it out there. And, you know, also, you know, my Twitter is Ironic Professor. And there's some harsh words get exchanged between me and the libertarians. So I invite folks to check that all out.
Thank you again for your time. And to your point about how dangerous it is for children's books to be so libertarian focused. I don't know if you've watched this documentary that recently came out about Imelda Marcos called, I think it's called The Kingmaker.
No, I don't even know that one.
Yeah, check that out if you get a chance. But towards the end of it, they go to a school in the Philippines and they're asking the kids like a history class. It's probably like around junior high, maybe like 10, 11, 12 year old kids. I forget. They're pretty young, but they're learning that the martial law period was the best period of prosperity in the Philippines.
Oh, it is ugly what people will do to propagandize kids. That's great. I will make a note to watch that, man. And dude, yeah, thanks for having me on, man. It's a great show, great guests. It's my pleasure, dude.
Oh no, it's always a pleasure to have you on. So yeah, I'm gonna play some music. Don't hang up.